Good afternoon. We're on a little bit tighter than usual schedule this afternoon, and I want to make sure our speaker has all the time we can give him until 5 o'clock, so we'll go ahead and get started. I want to welcome you all to the Vanderbilt Kennedy Center. My name is Elise McMillan, and I'm the co-director of our University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. And thank you for being here for our celebration of Martin Luther King and his legacy. It is my pleasure to present Bobby Silverstein, who is a nationally recognized disability policy advocate and analyst with more than 30 years of experience in developing landmark legislation. He has been gracious enough to meet with different members of our faculty and staff and community today, and I know we've all thoroughly enjoyed the time we've had to spend with him. Sure, I'm happy to do that. Okay, let me remember that later in this introduction. His career has been devoted to systems change on behalf of individuals with disabilities and their families. It's particularly fitting that he is with us as our own Martin Luther King Day speaker as he discusses the historical context of the nation's treatment of individuals with disabilities, the core principles of our nation's emerging disability policy framework, and his advice on how to become more effective disability policy change agents. I should mention that there are so many of you from different parts of this university, and truly we have to work together to begin to make this change, so we're really glad you're here. Mr. Silverstein has worked for 20 years in various capacities on Capitol Hill, including being the staff director and chief counsel to the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Disability Policy. He was the behind-the-scenes architect of more than 20 bills enacted into law, including, and this is really a who's who or a who's what in the laws on affecting disability, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act as amended, the Rehabilitation Act as amended, and the Developmental Disabilities Assistance and Bill of Rights Act as amended. He has received more than a dozen national awards, including the Distinguished Service Award of the President of the United States and induction into the Public Interest Hall of Fame. He earned his BS in economics from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and he received his JD from Georgetown University Law Center. He is now with Powers, Piles, Sutter, and Verville, a Washington, D.C.-based law firm that focuses on healthcare, education, and the law of tax-exempt organizations. I want to mention especially that he's joined today by his wife, Lynn, and also his son, Evan, who is a third-year medical student here at Vanderbilt. We're very glad to have you here, and I understand that Evan even recruited some of his fellow classmates and faculty, and we're glad that you did that because our future physicians have to understand these policies and be part of the advocating for change. Mr. Silverstein has touched the lives of so many that I could give you quotes from both sides of the political spectrum, quotes from Senator Edward Kennedy, our own former Senator Bill Frist, from both President Bushes, from President Clinton. But I'd like to leave you with this quote from Paul Marchand, and don't worry, I'm only going to say the good stuff that he said about you. Some of you may know that Paul is the longtime head of governmental relations for the ARC of the U.S., and he doesn't give compliments lightly, but here's what he says about Bobby. He is the number one unsung hero of national disability policy. He wrote dozens of disability laws during his stint on Capitol Hill, mostly as a staff director of the then Senate Subcommittee on Disability Policy. He did the work, the senators got the credit. He is also the foremost trainer on how to impact disability policy. Now, I mentioned the talk today will be a little bit shorter than usual. Bobby and Lynn need to get on a plane to be back in Washington tomorrow for inauguration, so we will go on until 5 o'clock. But we hope, with Evan here, maybe this won't be your last visit to the center. Maybe this is just a beginning. So it's really my pleasure now to present Bobby Silverstein.
Thank you for that kind introduction. In 1948, At the age of 18, a young man was diagnosed with polio. The young man's name was Justin Dart, Jr. Parents were very wealthy and very well known. His father was actually part of the Reagan kitchen cabinet. When his doctors had to chat with Justin's parents, this is what the doctors said. "Don't grieve. Justin is better off dead than crippled for life." That was the direction and advice from his doctors. Now, Justin's family ignored the advice of the doctors and found a place, a program that empowered Justin to live with his disability. And Justin lived to the age of 67. And during his lifetime, Justin became known as the Martin Luther King Jr. of the disability rights movement. He spent virtually every hour of every day advocating for social justice on behalf of people with disabilities. It was about 10 years ago that I was invited by Justin to go to the White House to watch him get the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which was given to him by President Clinton. A few years after he received this award, I received a phone call from Justin on a Saturday. And Justin, in a kind of scared voice, said, "Bobby, I'm scared, I'm dying, something is wrong." The very same person who had received an award by the President of the United States was scared to death to go to the hospital because he was afraid that when he wheeled in, he would be treated as an invalid not worth saving. The man who was empowering people around the country was scared about how the healthcare system would treat him. I immediately called a friend of ours who was at Georgetown University Hospital. And I said to him, "John, there is somebody very special to the disability community. His name is Justin Dart. We treat him like the Martin Luther King Jr. of the Civil Rights Movement. He needs to go into the ER, but he's afraid he will die waiting in the ER." John called the hospital. Fortunately, between 10 and 15 doctors and nurses greeted Justin when he arrived. Eventually, they diagnosed him as needing a pacemaker. While Justin and his wife Yoshiko and I were sitting in the hospital, we became, I wouldn't say more, but we became reflective. And we started to talk, and somebody, I don't remember who, asked the question, "What is true happiness?" And Justin responded this way: "True happiness is being part of something bigger than me or you. It is being part of a community, a movement, a struggle for social justice." He said experiences, wins, and successes along the way. That's good. That's important. But true happiness is facing daily challenges with beautiful people who share your dream. So today, on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, let's join the disability rights movement. Let's renew our commitment to the disability rights movement. And let me try to share some of what I learned from Justin and from other colleagues in the movement and how to make change happen for people with disabilities. Let's start with history, because some of you in this room might be asking the simple question, which is legitimate. Why a civil rights movement for people with disabilities? Why is it necessary? Isn't everything fine? Well, let's go back in time. Let's go back to our great philosophers who impacted on Western civilization and our society and our laws and our policies. Let's go back to Plato, who said, "Let's leave the unhealthy to die and those whose psychological constitution are incurably corrupt. We must put them to death. This seems to be the best thing for both the individual sufferer and for society." Aristotle said, "With regard to the choice between abandoning an infant or rearing it, let there be a law that no crippled child be reared." So when we fast forward a little bit to some of our laws in this country, it's not surprising that we would have ugly laws. In Chicago, for example, where a person with a disability, who had a physical disability, was banned from being seen in the public. And if they were, they were subject to fine and penalty. Let's go to education. There was a case in Wisconsin before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. The issue was whether a child with cerebral palsy was entitled to an education. Let me share some of how the court and the school board described this child, Merritt. Merritt has been crippled and defective child since birth. Slow and hesitating speech, uncontrollable facial contortions, uncontrollable flow of saliva presents an unclean appearance. This is how the school board summarized its description of Merritt. Merritt produces a depressing and nauseating effect on the teachers and school children that by reason of his condition takes up an undue portion of the teacher's time and attention, distracts the attention of other pupils, and interferes generally with the discipline and progress of the school. The court concluded that yes, Merritt could be totally excluded from public education. Why? Because his presence is, quote, harmful to the best interests of the school. Individual rights must be subordinated to the general welfare. Next issue, should a person with mental retardation be sterilized against their will? Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, a great Supreme Court jurist, said absolutely. Why? In order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence, it is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crimes or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Ever wonder why we had institutions in this country where folks with disabilities were forced against their will to be placed in these institutions? Well, the great PhDs of the time were saying, based on requests by state legislators, and this is quotes from the literature, people who are feeble-minded, which was the name for folks with mental retardation, were, quote, a menace to society and civilization, responsible in large degree for many, if not all, of our social problems. Justice Thurgood Marshall in a Supreme Court case summarized our treatment of people with disabilities as grotesque. And then he went on to say that our treatment in many cases were worse than the worst excesses of our Jim Crow laws. That is why we have a civil rights movement for people with disabilities. And fortunately, a number of laws have been passed over time. Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act in 1973, a civil rights statute that said recipients of federal aid couldn't discriminate. The Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, originally passed in 1975, requiring a free, appropriate public education for all children, regardless of the nature or severity of their disability. We had early intervention for infants and toddlers with disabilities, which said we need to focus on the family and provide support for the family so that they understood how to love their new infant with a disability. We passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, often referred to as the 20th Century Emancipation Proclamation for people with disabilities. Fair housing legislation, access to planes, Medicaid reform, Social Security reform, all designed to empower and enhance the ability of people with disabilities to live in the community. Now, what was the basis for these laws? What are the values and principles that are in these laws? First, we need to look at the old paradigm to summarize. The old paradigm, as reflected in those cases that I made reference to, starts with the premise that people with disabilities are defective and they're in need of fixing. And if we can't fix them, we're a failure as professionals and as society. They're vulnerable, dependent folks. Who cares if they're put away in separate schools and in separate institutions? That flows from the premise that they're defective and in need of fixing. In all of these laws that I refer to, 504, ADA, IDEA, we reject this old approach. And we put instead a new precept, a new principle, which is a very simple concept, but it's very profound in terms of its impact and effect. And that is disability, like race and gender, is a natural and normal part of the human experience that in no way diminishes a person's right to fully participate in all aspects of society. And our focus for those with chronic conditions is not on fixing them, because we're not likely to fix folks with chronic conditions, but rather to fix the environment in which they function. And from this precept stems four goals of disability policy. One, equality of opportunity. Two, full participation. Three, independent living. And four, economic self-sufficiency. One, equality of opportunity. What does that mean? Treat people as individuals. Learn the facts. Learn the best practices that work for them. Don't treat them based on fear, ignorance, stereotypes, generalizations, labels. Don't treat them based on convenience. Learn what is unique about that person. Two, ensure that the opportunity is effective and meaningful. What do I mean by that? Think for a moment that you're going to a class on the third floor, and the only way to get up is with a fireman's pole. How many of you in this room are going to be able to go up that fireman's pole to reach the class? We have stairs, we have elevators, we have approaches that ensure effective opportunity for the average person. What we're saying here with these new laws is that all should be able to take advantage of the opportunities. Not the average person, but all. That may mean an interpreter. That may mean alternative accessible modes of communication. It may be ramps, it may be elevators. But everybody's entitled to effective opportunity. The third part of equality of opportunity is the notion of inclusion. Why should a person with a disability give up his or her right to interact with his or her non-disabled peers in order to get goods and services? Why is that necessary? And the law says it's not. The presumption is that they can benefit from services in the regular environment with their non-disabled peers, with supplementary aids and services. The second goal is full participation. People with disabilities are entitled to control their lives. Professionals are facilitators. Professionals provide advice and services. But people with disabilities and their families need to be the center, the ones who ultimately make the decisions. And that's not only at the individual level, it's also at the policy level. We have phrases like empowerment, self-advocacy, self-determination to describe this concept of full participation. The third goal is independent living. Instead of dependency, we're talking about living independently. Instead of being dependent on benefits, we're trying to maximize economic self-sufficiency, the fourth goal. This is the essence of disability policy as reflected in these laws. This is important stuff for young docs, for young nurses, for students to reflect on these concepts. When a deaf person comes in, you don't talk to the interpreter. It is the deaf person who's sick. If a person gives birth to a child with a disability, your job as a pediatrician is to empower that family to learn how to love their child, not to scare. I won't use French. It is to help the family understand how to live with and to love that person with a disability. Now, how did we get from the old paradigm of defect vulnerability to ADA and an IDEA and a 504 and that kind of legislation? It just didn't happen, because in politics, status quo is the norm. Change is the exception. It happened because effective advocates like Justin and Paul Marchand and thousands of others learned how to exercise power. Pissed off was not enough. Angry was not enough. Frustrated was not enough. They need to learn advocacy skills. And in 10 minutes, I am going to summarize some of those, but obviously not get into them in depth. First, any advocacy effort must start with values and principles. You need to know what you're fighting for. At the core, you need to know those values and principles, because those are not compromisable. You don't compromise your values and principles. You will compromise different positions along the way, but you've got to be able to understand what those values are. You have to understand that if something's worth fighting for, it's probably not going to happen by one person. Justin Dart is not going to make it happen. It's going to happen if you're part of a coalition of folks who care about the same issues, who have not only the resources, but the different kinds of expertise that are necessary to affect change at the policy level. You have to be able to develop a strategic plan. You have to be able to think strategically. That means knowing what the real, we call it a reality check. Where are you starting? What's the strength of the opposition? What's the strength of the support? What are some of the dynamics affecting? What's the state of the economy? We've got to figure all these things out. We have to start with the reality in terms of current law. And then we have to be very sophisticated about how we frame the issue. What do I mean by that? Think about what kind of toothpaste you use. Why do you buy a certain kind of car? Madison Avenue has figured out how to do spins, how to, in a slogan, figure out what it is that you should buy. Well, we in the disability rights community also frame our issues. We have to be very sophisticated in what we say and what we don't, and I'll give you an example shortly. We have to control the dynamics of the debate. What we try to do is create what we call an aura of inevitability. You in Tennessee would probably not understand the notion of a snowball at the top of a mountain coming down and anybody in the way gets crushed, but that's the goal of advocacy, to create that snowball effect. And how do we do that? We get co-sponsors for bills. We get bipartisan support in terms of who introduces it. The Dems and the Republicans, the liberals and the conservatives. We get opinion leaders to write editorials or op-ed pieces. We try to create this dynamic in terms of the politics. We come up with justifications. We go to universities, to PhDs, to folks that have something after their name for credibility, to be able to have the research to show that this works, that it's cost effective, whether it's a PhD in economics or a PhD or an MD. We look for credible research to justify what it is we're doing. We tell personal stories and we tie them to our policy objectives. It is incredibly powerful to have a personal story. And what kind of story is the best? A success story, believe it or not. Start with a problem. Describe the intervention that's going to work, that you're trying to get adopted across the country. Then show how that person who is a problem becomes a Boy Scout, is a success, and it's a success because of this intervention, and then the research explains that it can happen across the board. In the education area, if we're talking about disciplining children with disabilities, you start with a child who is getting D's and F's, has no friends, is constantly in the principal's office. You have an appropriate functional assessment, a behavioral intervention plan by trained personnel. Lo and behold, this child turns into a Boy Scout, is elected to the student council, the suspensions go away. So what is the moral here? We need to not kick kids out of school. We need to provide appropriate interventions based on the facts. Those are the kind of examples that we're talking about in how to be an effective advocate. It's the kind of stories you choose. Next point, long-term relationships. I wish I could say that all the success is based on all these smart things that we do all the time. But oftentimes it's based on who you know. It's based on, and how do you do that? You develop trust relationships. And then the other point is finding the right champions to move your policy, your strategies forward. Let me give you a couple of quick examples. When we were working on the early intervention program for infants and toddlers with disabilities, we had a couple of hearings in Washington. At the end of the hearings, it was the end of the session, a Republican named Steve Bartlett from Dallas, Texas, wrote on a little napkin, "No way are we creating a new entitlement." So everybody thought that was the end of it. But we found somebody who knew Steve Bartlett, who convinced him to visit an early intervention program in his home district during the July 4th recess. We then said, what makes Steve Bartlett tick? He's a conservative Republican. He has a family. He believes in family. He believes the importance of family. He believes that we shouldn't have one size fits all imposed by the federal government. He believes that we're spending too much money on education. Maybe there's ways of saving money in terms of special education. So we knew what made him tick. We found a mom who was divorced because she gave birth to a child with a significant disability. We found a dad who was part of an early intervention program who said this program helped save our marriage and our family. We had a professional who talked about how some kids with early intervention did not need special ed, so there's a tremendous cost saving. Others needed fewer services and supports. We had another person, professional, talk about how we could phase in this program over time and how certain states and certain school districts were implementing this program. The long and short is we went back to Washington. 3 weeks later, we had a negotiated agreement, and the rest is history. A couple of parents and a couple of professionals with the right message, framing it correctly, talking to the right person, Steve Bartlett, who at the end of a session, a Republican, who's in this case a ranking member, was a key person, and we were able to go back and pass this legislation in a couple of weeks, because of a couple of parents and a couple of professionals who had the right message delivered to the right person. Another quick story, Americans with Disabilities Act. In the Senate where I worked, we had passed the legislation and it had a provision saying treat people based on facts, not based on fear, ignorance, and prejudice. Treat people based on science, not fear and stereotypes. In the House, there was a provision that said treat people based on facts and science, not fear, ignorance, and prejudice, except if you're HIV positive. And if you're HIV positive, it's perfectly acceptable to treat people based on fear, ignorance, and prejudice. Now, we were not about to pass a civil rights statute that included a provision that allowed explicit discrimination. But the way things work is you go to conference, House and Senate come together, remember Government 101, and you reconcile the differences in conference. Well, before we did that, the Senate has a provision that's called a motion to instruct. And Senator Jesse Helms, remember Jesse Helms from North Carolina, had a motion to instruct the Senate conferees to accept the House provision. And we had the best speeches you could imagine. Senator Harkin, my boss, Senator Kennedy, they were brilliant. We wrote the talking points, but they were brilliant. We had quotes from public health officials, from Ronald Reagan's personal physician. We were awesome. We lost 60 to 40. Now, fortunately, you don't have to follow a motion to instruct. It's just hortatory rather than mandatory. But we were still stuck in what to do. Well, another senator, Orrin Hatch, a conservative Republican from Utah, voted with Jesse Helms the first time around. We had a second bite at this apple and were able to revisit this issue. Somebody who had a personal relationship with Senator Hatch convinced him to reconsider. He called up Nancy Taylor, his chief aide, who was 9.5 months pregnant with twins, to negotiate language. The language said, and I quote, treat people based on facts and science, not based on fear, ignorance, and prejudice, and this was the amendment, and we really mean it. Now, it wasn't exactly that language, but what we said is let the Center for Disease Control and Prevention decide what the science was. with respect to infections of folks who are, HIV positive. So we had the language. Nancy had to go back to bed. And Senator Hatch says, oh, my God. What do I do? Who's going to write my talking points? And we took Senator Harkin, Senator Kennedy's talking points. We gave them to Senator Hatch. And he went to the floor of the United States Senate and said the exact same things that they did, and this time we won 60-40. Again, what's the message in terms of these tips? It's who delivers the message that's often more important than the message itself. So when we're talking about being effective change agents, we're talking about the exercise of power, and power comes through knowledge. Knowledge of what to say, how to say it, and who should say it, and when they should say it. It requires, like a lot of other things in life, skills. And it's not just something that happens. And so it's this skill part that is critical. If there's a problem that needs solving, it's worth learning how to be not only an angry zealot, but learn how to affect change in a positive way and get what you want at the end of the day. Now, is our work done? We have the ADA, we have 504, we have IDEA. Unfortunately, I don't think so. Anybody been to Chuck E. Cheese lately? You know what Chuck E. Cheese is? It's a place that I refuse to go with Evan because I'd get an absolute headache because it's a pizza place for kids where all they're doing is running around playing. Anyway, there's a Chuck E. Cheese in Madison, Wisconsin, hired a person with a developmental disability. The regional manager came, this is a couple of years ago, came and said, what is he doing here? We do not hire those kind. Fire him. He left and everybody ignored him because the person was liked and respected by all. He came back a couple of weeks later, required on the spot that he be fired. This went to trial. Guess who won? Hint, it wasn't Chuck E. Cheese. Then we go to the stage of damages. Chuck E. Cheese said, he's entitled to no damages. He's mentally retarded. He doesn't have any feelings. $13 million later, they had a different idea. December 15th, 2008, Newsweek. Beth Allard was recovering from labor, waiting for a hospital photographer to capture her newborn son's first day in the world, when a pediatrician walked into her room and told her that her life was ruined. She was told that her child had Down syndrome. The pediatrician said that he would be mute and illiterate. He would spend his life hanging off her, drooling. And then he got even harsher. You should consider putting him up for adoption. You're going to end up divorced. Don't even bother having any other children. Didn't you have the option to terminate? Finally, the pediatrician left, and Allard resumed her wait for the photographer. He never came. James Watson, the Nobel Prize-winning scientist who helped discover structure of DNA in 1953, this is from the Washington Post recently, quote, You would have to be crazy to say you wanted a child with Down syndrome, because that child has no future. 2006, headline, euthanized disabled babies, says doctors. A very disabled child can mean a disabled family. Bob Lansbury, in a recent article about IDEA special ed, instead of mainstreaming lifting the weakest of students, it lowers all students, it dumbs down the classroom. Students are not likely to see, get disproportionate resources and attention. That sounded awfully familiar with a Supreme Court case from Wisconsin from 1919. The current system is wasteful and ineffective. It guts school budgets, encourages needlessly expensive special ed, cheats regular students. So what's a better idea? Segregate kids with disabilities. Healthcare reform in Oregon. The great governor of the state of Oregon was going to have rationing. Okay, rationing. How is he going to do it? They had what was called condition treatment pairs. If you had a condition and the treatment resulted in somebody having a disability, then you didn't get services. Why? Because there was a survey done of non-disabled folks, and they decided that there was no quality of life if you ended up in a wheelchair or if you had a paralysis. And they surveyed docs, and the docs agreed. And then they surveyed people with disabilities after the fact, when they learned to live with their disability, and people were saying, excuse me? Yeah, I may be deaf. Yes, I may be blind. Yes, I may be use a wheelchair. But yes, I also have a quality of life, thank you very much. But it was docs and nurses and the non-disabled folks who in Oregon were saying we shouldn't provide services for those folks. Fortunately, we had the ADA. We informed the governor that what he was doing was illegal, and he had to change his policy dramatically. But to say that there's nothing left to do, there are waiting lists for people with significant disabilities who want community-based services and supports, who need personal assistance services, some who want to work, but because of policies, we have barriers to employment, work disincentives. We have a lot of work that still needs to be done, and complacency cannot be the dominant reality. We need the next generation of leaders who are going to step up to the plate, who are going to do what folks did and get down and learn the skills, the same folks like who helped enact the ADA and the IDEA and the Section 504. This is tough work. It takes a lot of effort and initiative to make these things happen. But we know that we can win if we have coalitions with skilled folks. Let me conclude with a few more words from my friend and colleague, Justin Dart. Again, our Martin Luther King Jr. of the disability rights movement. This is what he said. Get involved as if your lives depended on it, because they do, and the lives of your children and your grandchildren. You can be a soldier of justice. You can be a revolution of one. Let us unite in action, and let us shout together, each in our own way. Some will do it 24/7, some will respond to an action alert. Each in his own way. We have a dream. Join us in creating a society where everyone wins. Join us in keeping the sacred pledge. One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. In other words, let us join together and experience true happiness. Thank you.